sense of measure, no illusions as we take refuge in young man's pleasure, breaking down the dreams we make real.
What a match day this was. It's lights out and away we go. One down, one to go. Another town, one more show. Downtown, give me away, but you never came back. No phone, take your place. You know what I mean. We have the same dream, but you got a case.
Podcasting from Studio 2520, somewhere near Akron, Ohio, and live as usual, the paid subscription of Zencaster, the campus of Otterbein University. This is Tackling the Chicane. So this is a later release by the prog rock band Yes, 1983, and as you can tell, they had transitioned from traditional prog rock to sort of the 80s synth era. Song peaked at number 24 on the Billboard 100, number 3 on the Top Album Rock in the UK. Second song from that album, released as a very popular 12-inch mix on vinyl. But this is probably the second iteration of Yes with Trevor Rabin out front. But I do remember having the cassette, and it was quite a great little toss. So,
what was the old me when I listened to Yes a lot more would have known 9-5-2-something.
I know 1-2-5.
Yeah.
Name of the album.
Yeah. That was
it. So, yeah. But there's an a cappella version of this where they remove all of the musical part of the song, which is worth a listen.
Yeah.
To kind of get the range. Still very good vocalists.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
The old men. So
still kicking some of them. Still touring.
Yeah.
At all these years later. So good for them. All right. So busy show approaching here. Episode 79 all time of Tackling the Chicane, if you can believe it. We got the 2024 edition of the Chinese Grand Prix in F1 as the season continues to unfold in front of us. Red Bull dominance continues into China with a couple of interesting players making themselves known, i.e. the papaya this time around, as well as we will get into a couple drivers making buffoons of themselves, perhaps. This race was had no shortage of I suppose incidents, which is good because that'll give us something to talk about here, because top of the race. Not amazingly competitive, although, again, McLaren did make themselves known. After that, I've been told from the producer that we're going to do a little dive into Lance Stroll and his antics, perhaps, and maybe call him out on that. And then, speaking of antics, the story that has sort of shocked the paddock in IndyCar this week, when it should have been dominated by headlines of the Iceman Scott Dixon's Long Beach Grand Prix W, instead it was kind of taken away from him by Penske and their cheating, basically. So we will get into that. And then on the back half of the show, in FA Cup semifinal, basically to end all FA Cup semifinals, Coventry City versus Manchester United. Winner of that one earned a date with Manchester City in the final. That is 1 month from today. The FA Cup final there.
What a match day this was!
What a match day it was, indeed. In the the Premier League title race has taken twists and turns, so we'll update you all on that as well. Let's go ahead and get into the Chinese Grand Prix here. The first edition of this race since 2019, due to the pandemic. So this was this first time we covered a Chinese Grand Prix in our time here on the show. So really, I guess maybe overall track impressions from you before we get going.
Well, let me just say this. You know, Fernando Alonso continues to impress in qualifications and just overall hard driving. Always ends up in a decent position. Finished a little bit further back in the pack in this one, but during the actual race, still, we can't discount the Aston Martin car, because he brings out all of the performance in the car. Always just kind of hovering, you know, kind of making everybody sweat a bit in qualifications. So I just wanted to say that about Alonso. This one kind of went as it should have. Verstappen, obviously, dominant to the point where we were focused on kind of the mid-pack challenges in this race. Great stops for the Red Bull team, 2.1 and 2.0 seconds to get on those. I believe they went from medium or possibly a soft to a hard tire. Hamilton continues to struggle. what say you about that? I think that this is a guy who has mostly given up the ghost this year.
Yeah, I think Mercedes are at a point in time where they're not amazingly locked into this iteration of Formula One. I think they pretty firmly missed the boat in terms of the development of their car in this regulations, and kind of feels like they don't care too much at this point about this season's performance, if I'm being completely honest, as they look towards the future with a different driver lineup. Lewis Hamilton had a decent weekend overall. I mean, he qualified well in this particular campaign. He did okay in the sprint, I believe. He did maybe it was the sprint that he qualified well for and then shit the bed in Grand Prix qualifying. So I apologize if I'm mistaking that. But yeah, in general, he's not really a a driver that is making much of a splash right now in Formula One, which is obviously odd because we know where he's headed next year, and we know that the guy he's replacing has been sort of miles ahead of him this season. So I don't know. At this point, I kind of feel like I'm beating a dead horse a little bit, but yeah, there's not much that I've seen from Lewis Hamilton this season that has really impressed me in any way.
Yeah, I feel like he's kind of mailing it in at this point. And that could be due to a lot of different challenges with the car. But, you know, once you're signed for the next go around, you're just protecting yourself, making sure that, you know, you don't get, you know, injured or get possibly crash the car. But yeah, they're definitely struggling a bit with the makeup of the car, I think. I would like to see them be a little bit more in the race. But with that being said, you know, this one was fun to watch. We had a Bottas power unit failure. Lap 21, which brings out the virtual safety car for a bit, and then the safety car, and then the, I don't know what you want to call it, but the drama ensues as Lance Stroll jettisons his car into the back of Daniel Ricciardo. And watching it live, or, you know, recorded during the race, I didn't feel, I was like, okay, everyone checked up, he had nowhere to go. But then as I kind of read some pundit stuff, and you know, these guys have to pilot these cars, and I guess what happened with him going under Ricardo's car was he not paying attention? Was he just not skilled enough to check up? He basically drove the car under the car in front of him, which we don't see that very often.
No, so. It looks pretty stupid, probably because as an F1 driver, it's something you really shouldn't do, which is you should be able to at least react fast enough to where you're not, like you said, driving your car under the person in front of you because you were like a battering ram behind him. And it is just a very silly incident because you basically punish Daniel Ricciardo for nothing, really, for being in the race, and that ruins his day. And then, of course, Yuki Tsunoda also around that same point has to retire as well due to an incident. And, you know, a really bad day could have been just a bad day because of what Lance Stroll ends up doing to Ricardo.
Yeah, and so on Instagram, The Drive posted a rather lengthy commentary about how they felt or they feel about Lance Stroll as a driver, and basically saying to him, okay, your father has funded you since day one. You're not one of the 20 best drivers in the world, and you should not be in F1. It was four or five paragraphs. I don't know who the actual article writer was, but had some good points. I mean, I think a lot of this comes down to how he reacted to the press post incident. And, you know, you need to be a little bit more humble about what happened instead of not being humble and blaming it on, you know, everything else around you. I don't know. I'm not a fan of Lance Stroll. I think in earlier podcasts, we've kind of talked about how he basically is not that great of a driver. But I think this really put a lens on the fact that, you know, when Papa owns the team, you'll have some defense in your position because of that.
Yeah, I think that is the biggest issue with Lance Stroll, is that everyone knows his seat is never in jeopardy. Even though we know damn well Aston Martin would be a much better team if they just got rid of Lance Stroll. But I don't really understand from a money-making standpoint, if you're Lance Stroll's father, that, you know, why are you not trying to maximize the performance of the team that you own? Sometimes, you know, it can't just be that your son is the driver, and that won't change regardless of his performance, when he has shown time and time and time and time again that probably doesn't really deserve a Formula One seat. Now, deserve a Formula One seat is sort of, I mean, who really deserves a Formula One seat? Of course, the FIA and Liberty Media, who own F1, are going to tell you that it's the 20 best drivers in the world. Well, okay, that's maybe it is. Is Lance Stroll and Logan Sargeant in the top 20 of the best drivers in the world? I don't think so. So there's always room for improvement. And frankly, I think Lance Stroll has been someone that has been kind of out of his depth for a while now. And incidents like that, to me, just prove it.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is going to hinge on if Aston Martin F1 team gets sold at some point. Lawrence Stroll has basically said highest bidder will be gone. Obviously, if that happens, then things in the driver's seat are going to change for sure. But as I said, you know, this is basically, this race, you know, didn't really, other than that incident, didn't really, I can't think of anything else of note. We had some pretty good performances by the McLaren team, which they just kind of keep hanging around here. Mm-hmm. I'll take a Lando Norris 2 on the podium at, you know, any day.
Mm-hmm.
Perez just couldn't get around him when it came down to it. And Verstappen was so far out that there wasn't going to be any kind of contention for 1-2. But, you know, we see the Ferraris are, you know, 4 or 5. Alonso, as I said, just kind of keeps hanging around. And, you know, we just have to keep focusing on positions 4 through 10. And our buddy at Haas got a point. So
Yeah, another very solid outing from Nico Hülkenberg, actually. Qualifies 9th, finishes 10th. That's it's about as much as you can ask of him at the moment in that Haas machine. So it has actually been pretty refreshing to see Haas field what I would consider a competitive car and getting the points fairly routinely, actually, so far this year, which has been surprising. Granted, it's not been your big point scoring positions, but to be in the points regardless is an achievement for them. I kind of agree with you. The race itself, not a whole lot of major incidents. It was a sprint weekend. Sprint race kind of was a flop as well, if I'm being totally honest. These big kind of sweeping closed road courses are just right up this Red Bull's alley in terms of performance in the a lot of turns at this one. And if it's an aero package type of track, it's going to be Red Bull domination, which we know. The ones that offer more interest are the street courses and Monza, stuff where it's kind of you're on the pedal a lot more. So I wasn't surprised to see Red Bull dominance for this one. Like I said, like you said, it was nice to have Lando Norris split up the Red Bulls on the podium. Haas points day. Williams, terrible. Doesn't seem to be much improvement out of that camp. So
yeah,
just kind of same old.
Yeah, heartfelt spot for Williams' team. I really like James Vowles. I don't want to see them finish above Haas, obviously, but just they're much more likable than a lot of the teams that are out there. So
sure.
Driver standings, Verstappen 110 points. Perez right behind at 85. I say right behind, but not quite right behind.
Yeah.
And then there's quite a gap. We got a 9-point gap between Perez and Leclerc. Sainz at 69 points. And then Lando Norris rounds out the top five with 58. Now, if I scroll down a bit here, it gets a little closer. George Russell in seventh at 33. Alonso, as I said, hanging around 31 points. And then it kind of drops off from there. So early in the campaign, there's nothing surprising here, really. But all we need is a GP where someone takes a podium who normally doesn't.
Yeah.
And then we can get some points shifted around should that happen. Now, we got Miami coming up in 2 weeks, not this weekend, but what is this, our second or third? Is this our third go around? Yeah.
Well, second with the podcast, third go around of screening. So, but yeah.
Yeah. Constructor standings are not really worth talking about. There's a huge gap.
Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren, right?
Correct. Mercedes, yeah. Aston. Round out the top five.
Nothing then, surprising.
Right. So after that, Haas, 5 points, seventh position. If we can stay in seventh position at the end of this campaign, I'll be more than happy.
That would be, actually, considering the mood at that team heading into the season, seventh would be pretty exceptional. They finished there, 10th last year. So
And really the way that RB has performed, it's totally plausible that this team could finish maybe a position ahead.
Potentially. I mean, really.
Yeah, if they keep up the good fight. So
I have to imagine at some point Alpine kind of gets their shit together, even just slightly, because that's just a team that should not be, what are we, 4 or 5 rounds into the season and they have 0 points. That is not a team that should be there. So I have to imagine at some point they fix it even just slightly. Even just slightly. Which will make things more interesting towards the bottom of the standings there. But yeah, Sauber, Williams, Sauber especially, quite literally to me, offers nothing. That team is just, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. So,
yeah, other than home fans with this particular GP, the guy was a hero, even though he was mostly in points a zero.
Yeah, Joe Guan Yu.
I get that. So,
yep.
Yeah. So F1, that's pretty much the talk of that. And we'll look to Miami in the first week of May here. Got a week off so that they can jet to the U.S. and get everything set up. I guess quickly we will discuss a bit of IndyCar controversy, which had reared its head today with the Penske team.
Yeah, so IndyCar back finally into truly full swing. Opened up in St. Petersburg, March whatever the hell now, like 10th, where Joseph Newgarden won originally. And then they had their thermal club $1 million challenge, which was a total flop. And then an awkward, like, 4 weeks gap in the schedule into Long Beach, which was a really good race, actually. Scott Dixon qualified 7th, I believe, and ends up winning this one on a amazing fuel save run. It's Scott Dixon, so the Iceman, he can kind of just do things like that. So that was kind of the talk of the town until, I think it was Tuesday or maybe yesterday. I can't remember exactly, but basically I wake up, open Instagram, first post from IndyCar on my feed, and you see Joseph Newgarden stripped of his win at St. Petersburg, had been given the Pato Award. All the Penske drivers deducted, I think it was 10 points, and fined $25,000 each, which in IndyCar is not insignificant. And basically what the story was is that the Penske cars, for whatever reason, at St. Petersburg had the ability for them to use the push-to-pass, which, if you're not familiar, it's just a mechanism built within the cars that basically give them extra horsepower to go around, to overtake, or I guess if you just wanted to go faster, which you have a limited amount per race, sort of like IndyCar's DRS, basically.
Right. So IndyCar dictates the amount of seconds in any given competition that you can use the push to pass. And it's anywhere, I believe it's between 50 seconds and 200 seconds. I'm not 100% sure if that's correct. I think that's what I read earlier today. And it's governed by a system that is tied into the car. So it's electronically controlled, right? So just like DRS, you either have it or you don't have it based on the the regulatory commission says, okay, push to pass is open or push to pass is closed. And from what I read today, the Penske cars may or may have not figured out some kind of software where they could basically go around that governing body, and it was available. Now, what I find very interesting is apparently this has happened, or Penske had this cheat for a couple of rounds now. And my question in our chat today was, if IndyCar is watching telemetry, you would definitely be able to tell if Penske cars had that advantage. Mm-hmm. And why did you not at that point in time say this doesn't look correct?
Yeah, so it kind of opens up a big can of worms and a lot of ability to, I don't know, speak conjecture, because we don't really know exactly what was going on. What we do know is the Penske cars, at the very least, were able to use the push to pass on laps after cautions, like restart laps, when push to pass is not available. Now, Joseph Newgarden and Scott McLaughlin, knew it was available to them, knew they weren't allowed to do it, and did it anyway at St. Petersburg. Hence why I believe both of them were taken championship points away, and also Newgarden forfeited his win. And Will Power, sort of the elder statesman of the team, of course Newgarden's been there for a while, but Will Power, sort of the face of the team, he put out a statement and said, I knew this cheat was available to me, and I also knew I wasn't allowed to use the push to pass on restart laps, so I didn't. And he said he did nothing wrong. So it's kind of interesting.
That you just kind of hit on the key part of this. The drivers all know the rules. The drivers all know that push to pass is not available on restarts. And so you keep your thumb off the button, whether the light is green or not, on your steering wheel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the article I read today kind of put a black eye on the series. I won't put a black eye on the series. I don't understand how IndyCar should have known this at the point of at the point
when it happened.
Exactly. Don't come back like a couple of days later and say, well, we just realized it.
Here's the problem. Who owns IndyCar right now? Roger Penske. So there is politics here, you know. If 100%. Someone saw something wrong at St. Petersburg, who has the balls essentially to go, yeah, I think the entire Penske team is cheating right now, with really the only evidence you have being a screen in front of you. Now, obviously, someone, a committee or whoever at IndyCar, had collected enough data and had found enough evidence to make a compelling enough case to where IndyCar actually did put down fairly harsh penalties on Penske as a team. So I don't think it's fair to put a black eye on the series or say, how could the series have not known, when in the end, maybe a little slower than you would have liked, but in the end, they brought the hammer down on the team. And look, it is racing. Teams, there's an adage in racing, if you ain't cheating, you ain't winning. So to
and
say,
I thought about that this afternoon, and I feel like that's sort of correct. Mm-hmm. So any advantage that you have, known or unknown, you will take. I mean,
yeah,
I'll push back to the old NASCAR days in the 60s, where a particular team would load their hollow tube frame with buckshot to make weight, mm-hmm. and then dump it all over the track to become lighter.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing. So I understand any advantage that you can take is if it's out there for you to take that advantage, then yeah. You know, I agree. I don't think it's a black eye on the series.
No.
I don't think that it's going to happen again. I think this was kind of a checkpoint where they will put some other degree of technology in there to make sure that the button's not available. And mm-hmm. if you do use it because you've ducked software or cheated software or gone around the rules at some point, then mm-hmm. this will probably be looked upon with more scrutiny.
Yeah, and I do wonder, because the way Penske as a team framed it was, there must have been, they said that the ability to use the push to pass came because there was software programmed into the car that was there when they were testing out the hybrids before the season, the hybrid motors that they're going to be putting in this season, and that it must have just not come out of the car. It must have still been programmed in there to allow us to do that, when I think what maybe more likely to be the reality here is that they had found a way to cheat the system. But who knows? It's racing. Shit like this kind of happens a lot. So that's kind of just the way it goes.
Yeah. So there was probably a point on pit box to driver where what should have been the call is X driver, this is pit box. You may see a green light on the wheel for push to pass. Do not use.
Yeah. But yeah, that's having a lot of faith in humanity there.
Right. But
and what is hilarious is that St. Petersburg race, I mean, Newgarden was dominant. And by IndyCar standards, winning by 7-8 seconds, that's a big deal. So he that race was actually kind of a snooze fest because of how dominant he was. And then Penske was great again at Long Beach until Newgarden got into some trouble with Colton Herta, where it pretty much opened the door to Scott Dixon. But it is a little interesting because Penske have looked really, really good so far to start the season. And I'm now you kind of look at it from a lens of maybe they've been cheating. So yeah,
of course.
So we'll see. Barber Motorsports Park this weekend in Alabama, the GP of Alabama, and then the month of May. So,
well, and I'll be interested to see what if this is discussed pre-race, if media will cover this particular incident.
Mm-hmm.
Or not.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I'll definitely be keeping a close eye on that race this weekend. So looking forward to it. I think with that, we can go ahead and shift into some soccer here. Well, I mean, kind of just nail it on the head right now. We are going to be covering the FA Cup semi-final between Coventry City and Manchester United. If you're listening to the show and are, you know, used to the Premier League coverage, Coventry City, probably not a team you've really heard of So if you're unfamiliar, Coventry City compete in the second tier of English football in the EFL Championship. That is just one division down from the Premier League. So if you get relegated, that's where you go. And they have kind of been on a Cinderella run in this competition. Again, just kind of a refresh of what the FA Cup is. Sort of like imagine March Madness in soccer form, but it's much, much, much larger. 700 plus teams compete in it. Basically, if you're a club that's worth really anything, you're in it to some degree in England. And we've reached gotten to the point of all the way down to four teams now in the final, like I said at the beginning of the show, slated for May 25th at Wembley Stadium. This one was also at Wembley, so a nice neutral venue. Crowd was into it. So I guess, you know, this ended up being a thriller of sorts. I don't know. I don't know if we have covered a match from Wembley Stadium before on the show. So I'm kind of interested in your impressions of the venue, at least from television. And the I think it's always cool to see the 50-50 split of fans, you know, when you get deep into the FA Cup. So what'd you think of the occasion to start, I suppose?
Yeah, so you could tell that there was some empty seats, which I was mm-hmm. kind of surprised by, but it is a rather large
90,000.
Yeah. So I think they probably had, 50 to 60,000 people there. This one kind of got off to a really quick pace
mm-hmm.
with Man U. We had basically up until the 23rd minute, it was super boring. And I was like, oh, geez, this is going to be one of those kind of
uh-huh.
football matches.
Well, here's what I'll say before that, before we kind of really dive in. I had thrown around a few ideas about which match we were going to cover, because obviously, you know, the Premier League title race is quite tight right now, and we'll definitely be keeping a closer eye on that next time. But I had saw what had happened in this one and was like, I think this is going to be one worth talking about. So I think what was most interesting, because I had known how this is going to play out, obviously, before you were watching it, which we'll discuss, but it starts out, like you said, a little unassuming, and then Man United get rolling, and you're thinking, well, this is going to be a pretty standard Premier League team disperses the second division side at a trot, but no. So, yeah, what did you, I guess, you know, you get that goal in the 23rd minute to get started for Man United, Scott McTominay, the Scotland midfielder, with a great pass in from Diego Dallo. And at that point, I want to ask you, did you get the impression that this game was kind of done and dusted?
Well, according to commentary, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we see another goal, which I don't have the time stamp, but
45th minute.
45th. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
It was not. So the goals didn't come quickly. Header 2-0,
mm-hmm.
Man U. And then that's when I got the feeling that this was going to be, as you say, kind of done and dusted.
And yeah.
I made the mistake of after the third goal in the 59th minute, and I think it was Fernandez.
Yeah, Bruno Fernandez. Yep.
Who scored that.
Mm.
Found myself on the FF button. but yeah, Coventry comes back in the 71st with Sims, who gives a little life to the underdog team.
So what I will say is soccer is a very, very, very tricky sport, because there are so many times where teams will go up like that and you'll go, yep, this one is done. And 80% of the time, it is. And then there's other times, like in this particular match, where you go, yep, 3-0, okay, let's get on the clicker here, skim a little bit. Oh, shit.
Yeah. I found myself three times going, oh, shit, backwards. But, yeah, it ended up being one of the more entertaining matches to watch, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I also felt at some point during the 1-3 score, panning around, watching the Coventry fan base, that was very quite passionate.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of drew me back in. I mean, babies being hoisted up into the camera.
That was honestly the coolest aspect of this entire match. And the television crew knew what they were doing there, you know.
Sure.
Obviously, there's always the intrigue on the pitch, but what is so, so different from other sports in soccer is that the fans, they live and they breathe their football club, regardless of the country. But obviously, you know, in England, where that's foundational to the culture, it's huge. And for a team like Coventry, everyone knows Manchester United, you know, global brand. They've won countless league titles, money out the wazoo. But then, you know, little Coventry City makes it all the way to an FA Cup semifinal, which for some of those fans there, that is the biggest game they have ever seen their club compete in. You know, yeah. So when you go down 3-0, did you see a single Coventry City fan leave? No, you did not. No, you did not. Exactly. And what? Go ahead.
That was kind of what drew me back into the game. And then, you know, finally, we have O'Hare deflected 2-3 in the 79th minute.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're starting to see a bit of a heartbeat, right?
Yeah.
So what can happen now? obviously, we're going to go plus, I think it was plus 6.
Yeah.
In regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tie came in the 94th. Minute.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So 3-2, two great goals. A little lucky with the second one there as it fires off of Aaron Wan-Bissaka, the Manchester United defender. Regardless, it goes in. Ballistic crowd reaction. And okay, here's what usually happens. 3-0 up. Okay, one goal back. So be it, two goals back. Usually the club that's winning is thinking at that point, oh shit. Because if you get, if the team is scoring two goals in a row, they have all the momentum in the world. So you see Coventry press up the pitch, firing away. Manchester United just letting them do that for whatever reason. First off, there's no instance ever where Coventry City should really be giving Man United much of a game, even though this Manchester United team, as we know, is not very good. But still, I mean, pound for pound, they should be kind of miles ahead of Coventry City. But alas, obviously that didn't really prove to be true. So I'm really confused as to why Manchester United were kind of playing so lax as they just completely let Coventry City back into the game. And then sort of just not necessarily out of the blue, but almost like you were just waiting for it to happen. Penalty awarded to Coventry City for right. Handball, if I'm not mistaken. Right. And up steps Haji Wright. Now, Haji Wright is a gentleman you might be familiar with, a U.S. men's national team striker. He scored the goal, if you can cast your mind back all the way back to the World Cup, which seems kind of like ages ago now. He scored that goal against the Netherlands in the round of 16. That we end up losing, but for about 2 minutes, we thought we were back in that game. He has transferred to Coventry City this season and has really hit the ground running. So up steps Haji Wright, of all people, slots home the penalty, nice and easy, great celebration, slides it into the pitch, up, fist pumps, whole crowd's going wild. I mean, it was a really great scene for sure. And that had pretty much solidified Coventry City to make it to extra time. at least. And what I knew was going to happen, because it happens 99% of the time with extra time, is that not a whole lot happened. Almost every time what happens is neither team wants to lose, so they kind of just sit back and play conservatively so as not to open themselves up. Now, there was, in the 94th minute, Bruno Fernandes's shot, which fired off the crossbar. But other than that, it wasn't really, there wasn't really anything super significant that happened, which, again, fairly predictable. So then go ahead.
Was there an extra time goal that went to VAR because of offside?
Yeah, well, I think, let me go back to the, I'm sure there was.
I thought Coventry went up 4-3 in extra time before the PKs, and then VAR canceled the goal because of probably
offside. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Forgotten about that. For some reason, didn't mark that down. Go ahead.
I was like, okay, done and done.
Yeah.
4-3. And then VAR comes in, no goal. And then we have the penalty shootout, which was quite great to watch.
Yeah. Penalty shootouts are great when your team isn't involved, because when your team is involved, it's the most nerves you'll ever experience. It's just horrible. It is just horrible. It is like torture, because it's such a cutthroat way to end a game. You know, you just rely on a simple kick of the ball after 120 minutes of 11v11, and it comes down to one outfield player and the keeper, you know. So much of it is just a mental thing, a mental battle between the two, because in theory it's very simple. And it starts out well for Coventry City. They slot home their first two.
They do.
But things in penalty shootouts, things can get derailed fast. So you have a guy on Coventry, sky one, and all of a sudden the momentum's going the other way, you know. And I'm sure you've noted down, but Andre Onana of Manchester United, couple of great saves in that shootout. And that's pretty much that. Manchester United do pull through. But regardless, Coventry City don't really have anything to be ashamed of. I mean, they played very brave considering the circumstances and gave everyone quite an entertaining match to watch. And what it does set up is a Manchester derby in the final. So it'll be Man City versus Man United on May 25th for the final match of the season. Obviously, the Premier League race is still going on. It's sort of taken a couple turns. Liverpool lost to Everton yesterday, so that pretty much not necessarily ends their title race, but they're not in a good position. Arsenal are currently first, but Man City have played one less match than Arsenal and are down only 2 points. So only 1 point, actually. So if they win, they will go top. So still a lot to decide. Four matches left there. You would give the betting favorite to Man City, but who knows? Things can change. And also the Premiership, Scottish Premiership, comes back this week. five matches left there to sort out the title race, so we will be keeping a close eye on that as well. And then, yeah, Miami in about 10 days now, so lots to look forward to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, coming up on the hour mark, I think it's a show.
That is, I believe, a show.
All right. So I'll get gone. You're good?
Yeah, I'm good. I am good. We will see everyone next week.
Breaking down the dreams we made. Real.
For executive producer Richard Tanaka. We have no associate producers this week. This has been Tackling the Chicane, copyright 2024. We'll see you next time. No phone, take it back.